How's your car looking? Showing its age? Faded paint? Dents? Dings? Don't worry. Maaco is here to help. They're the experts in affordable paint jobs and light collision repairs, helping you keep your car looking its best without breaking the bank. With Maaco's national reach and community focus, you're not just getting top-notch service. You're actually getting a partner you can trust. Visit your local Maaco today and see how they can refresh your ride. Go in, get the free estimate, and the expert technicians will handle the rest. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Anatole is the author, most recently, of Climate Change and the Nation State, addressing these matters. And the matters come down to the People's Republic of China. There is also the matter of India and Russia. We will address them in order. I begin, Anatole, with much of the statistics of these last years have not improved when it comes to China and greenhouse emissions. This is Bloomberg Green reporting within hours. China is by far the world's biggest polluter, responsible for almost a third of fossil fuel CO2 emissions. The country's post-pandemic economic recovery puts its coal plants into overdrive, and its national emissions are expected to finish the year 5.5% higher than 2019, before the pandemic, at 11 gigatons. India's emissions, the third largest, were found to rise 4.4% over 2019. Coal use worldwide peaked in 2014. Researchers had noticed with some relief that coal was in decline. However, Anatole, the People's Republic of China did not attend Glasgow COP26 in a fashion that other large emitting nations such as Europe and the United States attended. Do you connect Xi Jinping's sudden and surprising decision not to attend either the G20 or Glasgow as a measure of the politics of this statistic about 5.5% higher than 2019? Has China decided to go it alone and dare us to stop it?
Yes, I think that's pretty much it. This, of course, is really, really disappointing, the coal figures. The Chinese do seem to have been highly influenced by, you know, the volatility of gas prices in particular, and the you know, the evidence of the failure of renewable energy, you know, to adequately compensate. And yep, they do appear to have decided to stick with coal. Now, on the other hand, they are also, so I'm told, gambling on the hope, but it is only a hope at present, that over the next couple of generations, two things will happen. One is carbon capture, that we will have technology for the capture of carbon that will basically make it possible to go on using fossil fuels and you know, without major emissions. And the second thing that they're hoping for, of course, is a breakthrough in large battery storage of electricity, which will allow us to store energy from renewables even when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing. You know, these are gambles. Everybody hopes that there will be these technological breakthroughs soon enough, but we don't know. They haven't happened yet. The other thing the Chinese are working on intensively is, once again, attempts at the development of new forms of nuclear energy, fusion energy, which would avoid most of the problems of storage and radioactivity of present nuclear energy. But once again, you know, many countries are working intensively on this, but, you know, we don't know yet whether it will happen. And, of course, even if these breakthroughs do happen, the Chinese and the Indians will still have to install them on a massive scale. So, that's not looking at all good. But by the way, I mean, one shouldn't just blame the Chinese, because the Indians have made a very long-term pledge to go to net zero. But they have also stated absolutely clearly that they too are sticking with coal for the foreseeable future.
The Economist magazine, in a feature, tells a compelling story about India and coal, and I want to recover what I can of it quickly. A young man who has ambitions with his bicycle to get a motorbike, and from the motorbike to increase the daily the harvesting of pieces of coal around the edges of industrial parks, where the guards allow him to take a few pieces at a time. He piles it on his bike as much as he can and carries it through the marketplace, selling it to people who buy it from him. He uses that money, saving up, to get a motorbike so he can carry more coal. And when he saves enough money, he'll be able to build a second story on the house where he and his mother live so he can marry. I tell the story because that is the scale of industrial coal use in India. It's not only big emitters and electricity. It's a simple young man who has dreams. How do we satisfy India's need? Because this is not what we recognize as a prosperous middle-class nation. In part it is, a subset of the billion-plus people. But you know more than I do that India is a universe of universes altogether. And Narendra Modi's pledge by 2070 is indeed brave, but that young man will be a grandparent by then if he's lucky enough to build that second story. And it doesn't answer at all the fact that his children and his grandchildren may inherit his task.
It's a terrible problem, as you say, and as the Economist piece brings out, you know, most Indians are still poor, often very poor by Western standards. But on the other hand, there is a terrifying prediction by the World Bank and by scientific organizations on which it relies, that if climate change continues, you know, if carbon emissions and climate change continues on its on their existing trajectory, then by mid-century, you know, in other words, only 30 years from now, the damage of climate change to India will be such that Indian economic growth will go into reverse, that the Indian economy will begin to decline, and hundreds of millions of people, maybe as many as 400 million people, will plunge again from the middle classes or lower middle classes back into deep poverty. Because the point is, of course, that in terms of temperatures, in terms of water shortages, in terms of vulnerability to floods and droughts, India is, you know, far, far more vulnerable even than China, let alone the United States or Europe. And so the point is that, you know, this poor kid, you know, will go on collecting his coal and selling it to burn, but that does not mean that his children and grandchildren will inherit a better life, because climate change will destroy that for them.
Russia, you're extremely sophisticated about reading the Russian public. I mean, you've just returned from Russia, from Moscow. And the puzzle for me, learning, I'm trying to catch up here, Anatole. The puzzle for me is that Russia is so vast, and it contains so many worlds within worlds. While India is the universe of universes, Russia is the world, but everybody's speaking Russian. But does the Russian public now respond to what we saw this last summer? The fires of Yakutia, the wildfires that spread smoke across the Bering Strait, across Canada, into North America. All the smoke that we had here in the East Coast wasn't just from the great fires in the west of the United States, it was also from Siberia. Does the Russian public respond to this? Because I've learned enough about Vladimir Putin's Kremlin. They're remarkably sensitive to public opinion. They can be driven by public opinion in some instances. Where is that public opinion now about climate change?
Public opinion in Russia has shifted in recent years. Previously, this was not something that most Russians, you know, really recognized or were terribly interested in. And there was also this, you know, very, very widespread belief, which you also find in Canada, that Russia on balance would benefit from climate change because, you know, agriculture would spread northwards to the Arctic. Now, these huge wildfires and heat waves have substantially changed that attitude. And also in the Russian government, I mean, 10 years ago, Putin was close to being a climate change denier, really. But of course, the question, as everywhere else, is, you know, what you do about it. Are you prepared to ask for sacrifices from the population? And Russia certainly hasn't really got to that point. And of course, Russia is terribly dependent on the export of gas in particular, but also oil. Coal, thank God, to a lesser extent. There are no plans to move away from that, from oil and gas in the foreseeable future. On the other hand, domestically, Russia continues to expand its nuclear industry, energy producing. Once again, a measure of some considerable courage, given, you know, the legacy of Chernobyl and so forth. And Russia is deeply dedicated now to reforestation. So it's a mixed picture. At least, you know, the population, most of it, and the government now do recognize at least that there is a real problem.
A puzzle. Europe is chilly in the winter. Sometimes you could call it downright Canadian cold. The same for the United Kingdom, a one-jumper day or a two-jumper day. Without Russian fossil fuel, Europe is going to have a very rough winter, the prosperity will dim, and the public will become alienated, which is not what you need when you're leading in transition. So, is the Russian emissions vital? Is it necessary in the transition? Must Europe turn away from chastising and sanctioning Russia and accept the fact that it depended upon Russia?
To an extent, yes. I mean, you know, not, of course, move to subservience to Russia. But the Russian position, basic position, under, you know, all the obvious official, you know, lies, it has been pretty clear. It's that Russia will fulfill its contractual obligations, which it has. You know, we will stick to our contracts, we always have. But if you want us to provide more, you know, to sell you more and not sell it to the Chinese or whoever, well, you better be nice to us. And, first and foremost, you better complete Nord Stream, you know, which the Russians say will then more or less guarantee Russian gas supplies to Europe. So, yes, I mean, for a very long time to come, Russian gas supplies to Europe and also to China will be essential parts of the energy mix in these countries until renewables reach the technological breakthroughs that will allow them to take the place of gas. But that, I'm afraid, will be a pretty long time coming.
Yes, there's regret that renewable sources grew 10%. In this year, 2019, but the renewables do not have anywhere near the growth prospect that we need in order to replace the fossil fuels. So this transition could go on for decades. And when we come back, I'd like you to address that and also give us a preview of your remarks in Glasgow, where you're attending soon enough. This is Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's the author of Climate Change and the Nation State, which is, of course, how we're addressing it right now, because without leadership, we're going to get a lot more uncomfortable over these next decades. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
What if every student had a tutor and personalized learning was available to everyone? What if every family had a financial guide and their investments made for an optimistic future? What if every doctor could diagnose you in seconds and healthcare visits felt more personal? What if your business never slept and every customer's shopping experience felt like it was designed especially for them? It can with Agentforce, the powerful AI from Salesforce.
Hey everyone, this is Carrie Champion, the host of Naked Sports. The all-new 2025 Nissan Armada Pro4X provides freedom. Freedom to explore, to go wherever you want, with your whole crew and all your toys. With a twin-turbo V6 engine, 8,500 pounds of towing capacity, and seating for eight, this unshakable fortress of a vehicle is built to take you on your next adventure. Drive the all-new 2025 Nissan Armada today. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Intelligent four-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
We all deserve some yay in our day. So say hello to Hello. Hello makes oral and personal care products that add wonder to your routine, like a toothpaste that makes brushing fun for kids. It's called Unicorn Sparkle Toothpaste. It tastes like rainbows and sunshine, works brilliantly, and it's fun. So it's pretty much magic. And for the adults, Hello Anti-Plaque and Whitening Toothpaste, which is just as good without the unicorns. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.